It's The Current's Music News, the daily podcast where we tell you what you need to know about what's going on in the music world. Today's Monday, March 4th. I'm Jay Gabler.
And I'm Jade, and we'll be checking in with our producer, Anna, a little bit later this hour to talk about the new Michael Jackson documentary.
We'll also be paying tribute to the late Keith Flint of The Prodigy. But first, a few more of today's headlines. Morrissey has announced a seven-night Broadway stand. His May 2nd through 11th shows at the Lunt-Fontanne Theater will serve as a career retrospective, reports the New York Times.
Is this going to be Morrissey performing the songs himself, sort of like the Springsteen thing, or is it going to be other people performing his music?
I can't imagine it will be much like the Springsteen thing because, boy, talk about two very different artists. Mm-hmm. But it is Morrissey live and in person himself, supposedly, if he doesn't cancel, because he has occasionally canceled shows.
Notorious show canceler.
This is the latest example of music taking over the Great White Way. You had the whole Springsteen thing, which was epic, and then you have all these jukebox musicals. This one is going to be a little complicated. As we mentioned last week, Morrissey is being increasingly called to account for all sorts of inflammatory statements he's made in recent years. But if everything goes according to plan, he is heading to Broadway this May. Pharrell is launching a new festival, and the inaugural lineup is not too shabby.
No, I saw this when it was being announced. It's awesome.
Missy Elliott, Janelle Monáe, Travis Scott, just to name a few of the artists who are going to be rocking Something in the Water, the name of a festival taking place in Pharrell's hometown of Virginia Beach, Virginia, from April 26th to 29th.
There's a ton of festivals, but I think you get something extra special when it's some musician hosting it and inviting their friends to show up, because then it doesn't feel like it's just a big, you know, kind of money grab for artists. It's actually like, these are my friends, these are people who I admire, and we're bringing them all together.
Yeah, and this is very much about sharing the hometown love. Virginia has had a rough time of it weather-wise and in some other respects in recent years. Pharrell Williams in a statement said, "Virginia has been home to some of the most gifted artists, athletes, and scientists to ever live. Virginia needs this right now, and the world will see what we Virginians have known all along. There really is something in the water." Just after we recorded last week's new music episode, surprise, another Knowles family surprise album.
I was so upset, and Jay had to bear the brunt of it, because I immediately sent out a message as soon as the show wrapped up saying, "No, Solange, no, why would you do this at midnight?" But well worth it.
That's right. That new album Solange had been teasing suddenly became a reality. The 19-track, 39-minute album is called When I Get Home. And appropriately, Solange celebrated the release with album experience events in her hometown of Houston. Few star collaborators, yeah, just a couple. Earl Sweatshirt, Blood Orange, Panda Bear, some Houston heroes like Devin the Dude and Scarface. It's just a lot to take in. Here's the album's most popular track so far, Almeida. It's a Pharrell collaboration featuring Playboi Carti. Still can't be washed away, not even in that Florida water. Not even in that Florida water. Singer Keith Flint, a founding member of British dance band The Prodigy, has died at age 49. Via the band's Instagram account, The Prodigy's main musician, Liam Howlett, wrote, "I can't believe I'm saying this, but our brother Keith took his own life over the weekend." Along with Maxim Reality, Flint was one of two singers in The Prodigy. Unmistakable in a double mohawk and dark eye makeup, Flint helped fuel massive popularity for The Prodigy, starting with their early 90s breakout in the UK. By the second half of the 90s, they'd achieved international fame, topping album charts on both sides of the Atlantic with their 1997 album, The Fat of the Land.
And this was such a influential album for a lot of people who ended up making dance music, house music, because before this, it was a lot of guitar-driven music. And this was really like music that shifted the paradigm completely and made people want to dance, and it creeped people out. It scared people. And that's kind of what you know good music is, if your parents are telling you that you probably shouldn't listen to it.
Yeah, kind of emo, kind of dark, but certainly like laid the foundation for so many 20th century dance bands who are coming out of that dance scene, but are putting on these arena-friendly, festival-friendly, huge spectaculars. They were the first dance band to headline Glastonbury, and certainly Keith Flint was a huge part of that ability to captivate a crowd.
And he had an amazing sense of humor for a brief period of time. A lot of people have been sharing stories about him owning this bar in a small neighborhood, and he had a fireplace in the bar. And of course, every now and then he would go and put some wood in there and light it on fire. And he had a little box on top of the fireplace because, of course, everyone's going to make the same joke, which is, oh, look at you, you're a fire starter. He would look at them, say, great joke, put a dollar in the jar. I'm a fire starter, twisted fire starter. You're the fire starter, twisted fire starter.
So you've almost certainly heard about the new Michael Jackson documentary, Leaving Neverland. Part one of two debuted on HBO Sunday night. Part two is going to play on HBO Monday night. Both are now available on streaming. And it feels like this is a film that's really changing the conversation around Michael Jackson, despite the fact that allegations of pedophilia and sexual abuse have swirled around the star for the better part of three decades. Our producer, Anna Weigel, actually saw part one. So we asked her to talk a little bit about what makes this film so frankly disturbing. Thanks for talking about this tough subject, Anna.
Yeah, it's a tough watch, you guys. And I think what maybe makes this stand out a little bit more than the rumors that we've heard over the years or the occasional headline or tweet is that this is a four-hour documentary starting from the very beginning. And it centers around two men whose names you might not recognize, Wade Robson and Jimmy Safechuck. And they both alleged that they were sexually abused by Michael Jackson as children. And it walks us back to the very first moment that they each met Michael. And do you remember that Pepsi commercial that Jimmy Safechuck was in a long time ago? He was 10 years old. He's walking around the dressing room. He has a Pepsi in his hand and he's looking for Michael. And he's looking at his jackets and he's looking at his glasses, and then right at the end, Michael shows up and says,
"Looking for me?"
And then he smiles at him. Well, being in that commercial started off a friendship between Jimmy's family and Michael, and in the documentary, he, now a grown man, goes into extreme detail of every moment of this continued relationship, which ended up lasting a couple of years. And then similarly, Wade was a very young child when he met Michael. He won an Australian dance competition and got to not only meet Michael backstage, but he was pulled up on stage to perform with him in his show that night. And that similarly started off a friendship between his family and Michael. And the documentary basically spends 2 hours going into every detail that went along with these allegations. And so HBO is facing a $100 million lawsuit from Michael Jackson's estate, and they're being threatened with litigation from another man that was mentioned in this documentary named Brett Barnes, who has said that this is not the way that his relationship with Michael actually was when he was a child. But either way, it seems to be making people rethink not only their feelings about Michael Jackson, but about listening to his music as well.
My understanding is that the documentary doesn't just touch on the most horrific details, which I gather are there, but the way that Michael Jackson developed a relationship with these two boys and their families, and there are photos and there are documents and there are faxes showing how this relationship was developed to the point where this kind of abuse could happen behind closed doors.
Yeah, and it's hard. I mean, there are actual physical details like you're talking about, pictures of Michael and the children, videos that he made for them. Like you said, faxes, that's one of the ways that he communicated with these children and their families. It's hard not to believe it, but certainly these men are sharing their stories from the very beginning until what I assume part two will go into more of who they are now and how this has affected their lives.
So the other day, for the first time, despite all these allegations over all these years, I had the first experience where Michael Jackson came on a mix and someone in the room was like, no, we're not going to do this. We're not going to play Michael Jackson anymore. Is that the feeling you're left with after sitting through the first half of this documentary?
I'm so torn. I haven't even wrapped my mind around my own feelings about it yet. It's becoming harder and harder, though, to separate the music with the man.
Well, thanks for talking about this, Anna. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
And certainly, Michael Jackson has had and has more fans than just about any other musician who's ever lived. And many of those fans, despite the disturbing nature of this documentary, are still jumping to his defense. The estate has shared some live concert video that is hoping people will watch instead of the documentary. The actor and singer Zendaya just debuted a new Tommy Hilfiger fashion collection at Paris Fashion Week, and she could hardly have picked a more traffic-stopping star to model her looks.
Well, this is... So I was actually watching all the photos as they were coming out, and the fashion line is very cool. It's very, like, 1970s. And the closer of the show, because you always want to go out with a bang in these big fashion week sort of situations, and all of a sudden, strutting out in this white swimsuit with a blazer on top of it is Grace Jones. And she's not just like strutting out like a regular model. She is dancing and twirling. And it was one of the more exciting ends to a fashion show that I've seen.
So this footage has been going viral. It's today's viral clip. And as Mashable notes, and I'm quoting from their post, Jones wasn't the only 20th century icon at the Tommy Now show. She was joined by pioneering women, including Pat Cleveland, Beverly Johnson, and Veronica Webb, each of whom made huge strides for Black women in the fashion industry. As Grace Jones, now 70, was out there working the crowd, looking amazing, the soundtrack was, of course, her 1981 hit, Pull Up to the Bumper. And that's today's music news. You can see that amazing video and read more about all these stories over at thecurrent.org. I'm Jay Gabler.
And I'm Jade.
Our producer today is Anna Wagle. If you're enjoying this podcast, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back tomorrow with more music news, including a chat straight from New Orleans as we celebrate Mardi Gras on The Current's Music News.